Just Energy with naturopath and medical intuitive Dr. Rita Louise. We have learned from Einstein's theories that matter and energy are one. Physicists believe that all systems in nature have their own particular way of vibrating. From the swing of a pendulum to the waves in the ocean to the light that brightens the sky each day, each of these oscillates at its own unique rate. In the same way, things such as rocks and minerals vibrate very slowly and at speeds that are imperceptible to us. Living things such as plants, animals, and man vibrate faster and appear to be alive. The same holds true for every thought, feeling, event, or word we speak. Each has its own frequency or rate of vibration. What many of us don't realize is if we take everything in our own universe down to its simplest form, it is all just energy. Join Dr. Rita as she explores questions such as, what are we made of? Why do we get sick? How can I live a more balanced and whole life? Call in and talk to her and her thought-provoking guests. Send us your questions and get the help you need to move beyond any obstacles or challenges that may be affecting your life, right from the source. So stay tuned and explore your possibilities.
Hello and welcome to Just Energy Radio. I'm Dr. Rita Louise and thank you all for tuning into the show tonight. Many of the people I have helped over the years were listeners just like you. If you are at a junction in your life, don't stand alone at this important time. Call me or send me an email and we can set up a private consultation so that you too can experience radiant health, healing, and wholeness in your life. To find out more about the services I offer, visit my main website at www.soulhealer.com. And for those of you listening to this show as a podcast, remember you can listen live every Friday night from 7 to 9 p.m. at justenergyradio.com.
I'm not angry anymore, and I'm not really sad. Still I have this puzzle in my head. Well, it's a crazy time to breathe. It's a crazy time to feel. Still, I'll just sit here and receive. While the simple voices speak to me in the darkest summer day, little voice seems to say,
I'm
from the restaurant.
So I'm out of here.
Yep. Ooh, and we're back. I'm not used to having music playing during the show, but everything is well. The mystery is solved. We have a guest, and we are moving forward along with the show. Woohoo! So it's all good. So let me tell you what we're doing tonight. We're still talking about the high wisdom of ancient Egypt, and to share that with us, we're going to be talking to John Anthony West. John Anthony West is a writer, scholar, and Pythagorean born in New York City. He is the author of The Traveler's Key to Ancient Egypt and consulting editor for the Traveler's Key series. His previous book, Serpent in the Sky, The High Wisdom of Ancient Egypt, is an exhaustive study of the revolutionary Egyptological work of French mathematician and Orientalist, the late R.A. Schwaller de Lubitz. So please, welcome to Just Energy Radio, John Anthony West. Hi, John.
Hello, Rita. Listen, I am really sorry. I knew this was on, and a friend of mine I was supposed to have dinner with tomorrow night called up. I can't make tomorrow, and can we do it tonight? And I just didn't put two and two together and said, yeah. So I'm at the restaurant, but we can continue. It's not the end of the world, and really major apologies. I don't know how to make this up to you, but I'm here. So fire questions away, and I will answer them as long as the cell phone keeps
working.
I thought
you might have been lost under a sand dune or locked in a sea.
No, not even that. And I can't even justify it by saying, oh, well, it's age, you know, and Alzheimer's and all that sort of stuff. No, I just absolutely slipped my mind, and there we go. So I'll make up for it by talking faster. How's that?
Well, you know, it was just going to be an interesting show. I have a friend over, and I'm like, come on in here. We'll just talk about Egypt. And it's like, are you kidding? It's like, come on. It's like sitting in the garage, how we do, and just ramble on for hours at a time. So it'll be good.
I guarantee to provide coherent ramble. How's that?
And I'm sure we're going to have a great time. I've been so excited about having you on the show because Egyptology is one of my loves. And so we're just going to get into it.
Okay.
So now I'm all like wired up and I have all this extra adrenaline flowing through me. So now you're going to have to put up with that.
It's all right. I'll do that. And me too.
No.
So sudden here I am, right.
So
go ahead. Fire away.
All right. So when we talk about Egyptology, there just seems to be this huge conflict between what the early Egyptians supposedly knew and what they were able to achieve. For example, when you go back very early in Egyptian culture, they were able to produce like the pyramids and vessels that were very finely crafted. And as you move forward in history, one, the quality went down, which, you know, in the United States, the quality goes down the more in advance we go. But people think that 35,000 or 3,500 years ago or BC, that they weren't really very smart people. And so how does an Egyptologist resolve the conflict between them being
resolves the conflict very simply by not realizing that there's a conflict there, or by denying that there's a conflict, because there is a very big conflict indeed. And yes, Egypt runs the opposite of the way civilization is supposed to run. It's supposed to go from simple and primitive beginnings to more and more complex and sophisticated results. And we look at our own technology. Yeah, I mean, the first computer took a whole house full of cathode ray tubes or whatever the hell they were, and now it's on a little thing you can hold in your palm of your hand. The first automobile was a horseless carriage. That's exactly what it was. It was a carriage without a horse with a little bit of an engine, and gradually, all of a sudden, we have the 2009 Ferrari, which is barely recognizable, or it would be hard to imagine, let's say, a Martian coming down looking at either 2009 Ferrari would have trouble imagining that it was actually traceable back to the 1892 Duryea or Mercedes or whatever the devil it was. But in Egypt, it's quite the opposite. There seems to be kind of Neolithic hunter-gatherer, relatively simple societies, and then all of a sudden there are the pyramids, and it's even more amazing than that, actually, because even in those earlier beginnings, there are certain artifacts that you mentioned them, the stone bowls, that we couldn't reproduce today. We don't know how they were made. These bowls. Vase is really made of some of the hardest stones that exist, that are hollowed out on the inside and have narrow necks. And nobody can figure out how the devil made those things. And those appear in very early burials where everything else is actually quite primitive and simple, little clay pots and fish hooks and combs and that sort of thing. And all of a sudden, these amazing pots, which actually... Big complicated question, but we think, that's myself and my colleagues who agree that the whole thing is that there's a prior civilization to dynastic Egypt, which is the Egypt that we're familiar with, and that those amazing stone bowls could be artifacts, heirlooms from that still earlier society. That's all absolutely conjecture, but not conjecture on stone bowls. And that nobody knows how the devil they were made, or when they were made, or anything else. So when we deal with Egypt, actually, it's mystery piled upon mystery, and academics, who I like to call quackademics, do not like mysteries. The academics abhor a mystery the way that nature abhors a vacuum. They can't possibly accept the fact that they don't know everything, or anyway, what they don't know is inconsequential and just an extension of what they do already know or think they know. So when we deal with Egypt, we're confronted by a total disconnect. There's no other discipline on earth, none at least that I know of, in which the same facts. And the facts are the facts. I mean, there are the temples, there are the pyramids, there are the tombs, there are the writings, in which the same data, the same facts, give rise to two such diametrically opposed interpretations. And the one, the symbolist interpretation, which I, of course, espouse and promote, it's a civilization in full command of what Shlomo de Lubitsch called a sacred science. That is to say, a science as scientific as our science, but based upon cosmic principles, and perhaps more important in terms of our own non-civilization and where we're heading, a civilization that understood that we as human beings have a function to play in this grand cosmos of ours, in this grand scheme. We have both a privilege and an obligation to conduct our lives in certain specific ways to certain specific goals, which the Egyptians basically called the immortality of the soul or eternal life, and what Schroller called, in order to just to avoid specifically religious terminology, which is hard to avoid actually, but Schroller called it the return to the source, which is the divine source. And that's what we're here for, according to the ancient Egyptians, and this is what their entire civilization is about. In other words, when you go to Egypt, and I leave trips there all the time, study tours, intensive study tours, we're really introducing this amazing civilization to people willing to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning to be there before anybody else is there. And at the end of a couple of weeks there, they understand... At least they understand with their guts and with their hearts what otherwise you can understand intellectually, but you don't feel it, not quite. And when you spend 12 days there, you end up understanding the difference between civilization and progress. What we call progress is the antithesis of civilization, and I like to call it shiny barbarism. And you, at the end of 10, 12 days in Egypt, you understand why they did what they did. We still don't know how they did what they did. We really don't know. But you understand the purpose of it, which is not the propitiation of these evil gods or the worshipping of, you know, these strange things that are half animal or half bird and half human, which the quackademics always attribute to still earlier periods when there was an animistic society around. In a nutshell, everything that we've learned in school about very ancient history is completely wrong, except the facts. More or less okay.
Well, let me ask you this question. So they found pieces that seem to be difficult to make or impossible to make at this point in time. Had they found evidence of a similar nature in other cultures? So as an example, in the Stonehenge area, they still can't figure out how they built Stonehenge, but have they discovered, to your knowledge, any other, you know, I know around Stonehenge they haven't really found anything, but they've found that new site that was off to the side, and have they found anything that might be parallel to something like those bulls? Or in Sumeria, have they found parallel items that don't really go with the agricultural culture that was also there?
Well, Stonehenge, nothing that's megalithic, and the megalithic sites all over, all over Europe, they're in Africa, they're in America, they're in New Zealand, they're all over the place. Nothing that's megalithic corresponds to anything that's agricultural. I mean, they don't know why the hell they did these things. And in certain cases, with Stonehenge, they don't know how they did them either. But even the smaller stone circles, there's one in Egypt that they discovered fairly recently, that is in west of Abu Simbel, deep into the Sahara, in a place called Nabta Playa. And it's not Stonehenge. I mean, the blocks of stone don't weigh 40 tons. They're about the size of a small car. But there they are in the middle of the desert, oriented in, you know, astronomically, very precise astronomical orientations. And the dating, which, again, this is the quackademics, not us talking, takes it back to about 6,000 B.C. So all of a sudden...
Oh, well, that's further than 3,500 B.C. Woohoo!
This is going way back. And as soon as astronomy is involved, you are not dealing with hunter-gatherers anymore, because they don't need solstices and equinoxes to tell them when to plant anything. This is the usual thing. Oh, well, they discovered astronomy because they needed to know this for when to plant the seeds and all of this. This is absolute stupidity. It's invented by people who have probably never grown a radish. Anybody who lives in the country or spent any time in the country knows exactly when spring is coming. And it doesn't matter if it's a week this way or a week that way. You know when it's spring, and you know when to plant. You don't need to erect 40-ton blocks of stone in a particular kind of a circle oriented to solstices and equinoxes to know when to plant your seeds. But you see, there's more involved in this than just stupidity. There's a lot of stupidity involved, but it's more than that. There's a philosophy involved, and that is that in the absence of any real functioning religion nowadays. We have lots of religions still around, most of them busy telling, you know, people which hand to wipe their butt with, or who they should marry, or what they should do. But the religions, at least externally, the religions that are still functioning today are hopelessly depraved and degenerate. And this leaves the scene open for the only religion that actually has power today. Are we there? What's happening?
Yeah, we need to take a quick break. I'm Dr.
Okay, let me know.
We're talking to John Anthony West about his book, Serpent in the Sky, The High Wisdom of Ancient Egypt, and we'll be back after these words from our sponsors.
Just Energy Radio with your host, Dr. Rita Louise, will return right after these messages.
Are you sensitive to energy? Want to explore the world beyond the five senses? Looking for a new career as an alternative healthcare practitioner? Then the Institute of Applied Energetics, Medical Intuition, and Energy Medicine Training Programs may be right for you. Our comprehensive curriculum provides students with a deep understanding of how to detect, evaluate, and transform the subtle body, as well as techniques for correcting energetic imbalances that may underscore a person's ability to experience radiant health. So if you are sensitive to energy, contact the Institute of Applied Energetics right away. Be a catalyst for changing the way healthcare is done around the world. Visit www.appliedenergeticsinstitute.com and start your new career today. Hey, it's Dr. Rita Louise. Don't forget to sign up for our free online newsletter at justenergyradio.com. It'll keep you informed of who's coming on the show each week. And don't forget, explore your possibilities every Friday night. Don't miss a single episode of Just Energy Radio. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Are you feeling stuck and unsure which way to turn on your path? Do you lack focus and direction in life? Do you feel something is missing? So what do you want? A better job? Your dream home? More money? Your ideal mate? Decora has practical tools to assist you. Schedule a session today to get clear about what you truly desire to deliberately create the life you want. For more information, visit ManifestingConsultant.com or call toll-free 1-800-813-3877.
Go deep inside yourself and venture into the realm of the unconscious mind with my Meditating on the Kabbalah guided imagery audio CDs. Discover who you are and what you want in life. Meditating on the Kabbalah can help you to open, clear, and revitalize the energetic pathways of your subtle being. They will support you in your spiritual quest by helping you to access the profound insights and inner guidance you need as you work in alignment with your highest good. Let them help you to release negative thoughts and emotions and clear away any limitations that may be keeping you from experiencing your full potential. Walk down the path to health, healing, understanding, and enlightenment with Meditating on the Kabbalah. Order your copy today at www.soulhealer.com. That's right, that's www.soulhealer.com.
And now back to Just Energy Radio with Dr. Rita Louise.
Hello and welcome back to Just Energy Radio, which you're talking with John Anthony West about the high wisdom of ancient Egypt. So before the break, we were talking about stone circles and its use in astronomy. One of the questions that I have is, what you were making the comment that they didn't need to have these scientific astronomical machines in order to plant crops. But how could somebody call a group of people primitive when so far back in time they had such a deep and profound understanding of astronomy?
I was talking about religion, and what we have today, what calls itself religion, is deeply degenerate. But it is actually, it's unfortunate, but it's on its external level that it's seriously degenerate. But underlying it, though you wouldn't know it from listening to the people who are supposed to be our religious leaders talk, there is philosophy and cosmology, and there's actually science behind it. But the opposing religion, which calls itself doesn't call itself a religion at all. It calls itself rationalism, materialism, and it is what I call the Church of Progress. And it has a certain dogma that is unchallengeable, and that is, since it is based upon nihilism, it's based upon hopelessness. In other words, it's based at the very bottom of it, the rocks, the cinder blocks supporting the foundation of the Church of Progress are nothing other than the Darwinian theory of evolution, which is that we are accidental glitches in an accidental universe. By extension, there are and can be no real values. And in fact, the quackademics, the Darwinians and the materialists they've got a problem with this, because they fight for their own religion as passionately as any fundamentalist Christian fights for his or her beliefs. But in fact, it's understandable with a religion, but what passes the science, where there are no and there are and can be no values, what is the survival value of truth? There is none. Where are the values? Doesn't matter. Shouldn't matter to them, and yet they battle it. But to them, the central dogma, the underlying, the, let's say, unchallengeable premise upon which the whole thing is structured, is that we of the 21st century are the most advanced and evolved beings that have ever existed upon this planet, with our hydrogen bombs and our depleted uranium weapons and our nerve gas and our bobblehead dolls and our Disneyland.
Let me just stop right there. So, is that really a true statement?
What?
That
we're the most
evolved beings
that ever
had? That we are actually the most advanced culture that has lived here?
That's central to everything that you have ever been taught in school.
Well, I understand that, but in your opinion, we're the most advanced culture that's ever lived here on the earth?
No, I think that I call this civilization shiny barbarism. It's infinitely stupider than anything that goes on in the deepest valleys of Papua New Guinea. I mean, we're intellectually and technologically pretty advanced. I mean, it takes some doing to create a hydrogen bomb, 3 chairs, but from the philosophical point of view, from an emotional point of view, from an artistic point of view, from any point of view that made life worth living over the last as long as there's been civilization, we're at the very bottom of that level. And the people who are in charge of the whole thing, the people who run the universities and who run the government and who run the financial side of things, are the most primitive at all. But this is not to say that they're not clever. So there's this total disconnect between real civilization, which is what we have in front of our noses in Egypt, and we have it elsewhere as well. It's just that nowhere can we actually experience it as emotionally and as viscerally as in Egypt, because there's so much of it left. So China had it, and India had it, and Mesoamerica had it, and in a different form, without the fabulous art and architecture of the American Indians had it. Everybody had it, if you go back far enough, and you can even see it. I mean, for example, things that are normally not understood. I mean, nobody even makes an attempt to understand them. The wonderful cave paintings of the Dordogneas of southern France, which go back to Lascaux is 17,000 BC. The dating is probably correct. The most spectacular of all is a place called Chauvet, which was only discovered somewhere in the 1990s. And that's 31,000 BC. And the paintings there, done with very crude technology, have the emotional impact of something like a cross between Picasso and Rubens. I mean, this is amazing work. And to imagine that the people who did it in these deep caves, hidden from other people's eyes, that the people who did this extraordinary stuff are somehow or another primitive and the jackasses who are busy running into Walmart to, you know, trample employees to death in order to get at the cheap jeans are somehow or another more advanced than that, or the other imbeciles that are busy producing depleted uranium weapons and weapons of mass destruction and nerve gas and all of the hideous garbage that these extremely clever but degenerate buffoons are producing are somehow or another superior to what went on before is a joke. And
but you know,
really,
if you go, if you think, okay, there's today, and you go forward in history 3,000 years or 4,000 years, and they look back at our culture, I'll just share this with you. So the King Tut exhibit is showing in Dallas. So I was there opening day, first thing in the morning.
Right.
And the entire day, we just kept making these jokes about, you know, in the future, they're going to find the McDonald's plastic cup, because, you know, they won't biodegrade, and they're going to think they are ritual cups and canopic jars.
Well,
because everything that goes back in history, there's always some religious significance to it, which may or may not be true.
Well, yes and no, but with Egypt, we know enough of it. We actually have it at our disposal. So we can do a reasonably good job at determining what they were on about and why they did what they did. And actually, for us, it wouldn't take much to understand the total absence, let's say, of enlightenment and of spirit in a McDonald's. Actually, somebody did, and I forget who it was, back in the 90s. I was an archaeologist who did a mock, exactly what you're talking about, a mock archaeological sort of study, pushing it forward like 7,000 years into the future. And they were archaeologizing, you know, the ruins of a motel. And they were doing exactly that, sort of saying, well, you know, all here exists, and it was a religious object, and such was a, you know, a ritual, something or another. And yeah, they might or they might not do that. But you see, there's a big difference between finding the ruins of McDonald's 5,000 years from now and finding Tutankhamun's treasures, because a plastic cup is a plastic cup, and the ugliness and the stupidity of the McDonald's, any McDonald's, you know, burger joint is obvious to us and would be obvious to anybody 7,000 years from now. Nobody is going to be moved by these things. And remember that such treasures are spectacular as they are by Egyptian standards, actually rather degenerate. The earlier work is purer, more powerful, less cluttered, and of course the artwork is, you know, we don't understand, to us, you don't extend, geniuses don't work producing masterpieces in order to put those masterpieces in a tomb that's never meant to be opened. It's very difficult for us to get into the mindset of people who would do that. But when you get to the temples themselves, so you look at this wonderful stuff, and remember, when you went to that King Tut exhibit, that's about 5% of the actual collection. The other 95%, and most of the really great stuff stays in Cairo. So anybody
it was good, but it was...
Oh, yeah.
They didn't have the head mask, they didn't have the coffin, there was...
We were
a little disappointed, but there were some gorgeous pieces there.
I have
nothing to complain, and it was, you know, I'm not complaining.
It is gorgeous. It is gorgeous, but the real impact of Egypt really comes from the temples, because those are meant to be used. I mean, those are functioning, gigantic, spiritual, musical instruments, and when you walk into one of the temples, and particularly if you get it a little bit to yourselves, I always go way out of my way to make sure we get there when other people aren't there, if humanly possible. When you go into those temples, that's when you get, and the pyramids, of course, then you get the hit. You get the sense of what's going on in the civilization. And then when it gets explained to you via the symbolist interpretation that Saul is a little bit put together, all of a sudden you start, or I won't say all of a sudden, gradually, the end of a couple of weeks, you begin to appreciate the difference between the shiny barbarism that we call progress and the real civilization that was Egypt, and by extension, not just Egypt, but also the other places on Earth that actually had the same religious, spiritual, metaphysical doctrine, but whose works are no longer around, at least not in the kind of quantity and quality that we have of Egypt. So this is the lesson that you get and can only get firsthand from Egypt. I mean, you can read about it, you can listen to me on the radio, you can look at videos. I often say that Egypt is like sex. And people say, oh, why is Egypt like sex? I say, well, because you can read all about it and you can look at pictures, but until you've experienced it, you don't know what it's about. So Egypt is like that. And it really is. I'm having fun, but I'm not actually making a joke, because there's absolutely nothing like it. And the weird thing is that it has been preempted by the dullest, least imaginative, and least creative scholars on Earth. This is a very weird thing. The most spectacular of all civilizations has been commandeered by the people least capable of understanding what it's about. It's a very strange... I mean, I don't understand
it
either.
It just
other
seems like they want to keep it all in this nice, neat little box, because if they let it out of the box, it will change the timeline, and that can't happen.
Well, that's part of it, yes. But more than the timeline, it's the philosophical and the metaphysical line. They don't even think it through, actually. I know these guys pretty well. You know, I deal with them all the time. And they haven't even thought it through. They just know that it's dangerous. And an Air Force friend of mine, we get this huge amount of flack and abuse, and an Air Force friend of mine says there's an Air Force saying, which is, the flack is always heaviest when you're right over the target. So, you know, we get our share of abuse, but I'm pretty good at giving it back. So it comes with the territory. But yeah, they... If you ask them, if you went to a conference or something like that and said, why are you so opposed to this? They would not say, well, because if it were true, we'd have to stop believing everything we've been taught. They'd have some other bullshit excuse as to why they couldn't believe it. Well, all the consensus is, and that we have this evidence, and there's the Statue of Khafra, and there are some geologists who don't buy into the water weathering theory, and don't believe me. They would never for a second say, well, we fight this because if it were true, everything we ever learned is completely wrong. They would not say that. They'd find a way of dodging around the issue. But basically, that's what's involved. If this is correct, if symbolist Egypt is correct, if the water weathering theory about the Sphinx is correct, they're dead. Right?
Yeah. Commercial time. I'm Dr. Rita Louise. We're talking to John Anthony West about his book, Serpents in the Sky. And we will be back after these words from our sponsors.
Just Energy Radio with your host, Dr. Rita Louise, will return right after these messages.
And discover alternative solutions to your deepest concerns at soulhealer.com. So whether it's a physical problem, an emotional issue, a question about work, or troubles in your relationship, naturopath and medical intuitive Dr. Rita Louise can help you. Bring peace, harmony, and health back into your life. Schedule a session today. Visit soulhealer.com right away and live the life you've been dreaming of.
Hi, I'm Dr. Rita Louise, the host of Just Energy Radio and the founder of the Institute of Applied Energetics. Start a new career today on the leading edge of alternative health and healing. The Institute of Applied Energetics can help you develop the specialized skills you need to work as an energy medicine practitioner, intuitive counselor, or professional medical intuitive. Besides our outstanding technical instruction, our programs also support you in creating and building a successful business in this rapidly growing field. Be a catalyst for changing the way healthcare is done around the world. Contact the Institute of Applied Energetics right away or visit AppliedEnergeticsInstitute.com. You can get a copy of Dr. Rita's latest book, Avoiding the Cosmic 2x4, by visiting www.soulhealer.com. Get your copy today.
Just Energy Radio wants to help you grow your business. Just Energy Radio has a growing global audience which can provide you with an unequaled opportunity to educate thousands of people about the products and services you have to offer. Through our targeted market, your ad is more likely to connect with like-minded individuals who will respond to your message. In addition, our archiving feature will allow your ad to be heard over and over again. Join the internet marketing revolution and take advantage of our low introductory prices. Visit JustEnergyRadio.com for more information.
The crossroads in your life and discover alternative solutions to your deepest concerns at soulhealer.com. So whether it's a physical problem, an emotional issue, a question about work, or troubles in your relationship, naturopath and medical intuitive Dr. Rita Louise can help you. Bring peace, harmony, and health back into your life. Schedule a session today. Visit soulhealer.com right away and live the life you've been dreaming of.
And now back to Just Energy Radio with Dr. Rita Louise.
Hello and welcome back to Just Energy Radio. I'm Dr. Rita Louise and we're talking to John Anthony West. His website is www.jawest.net about his book Serpent in the Sky. So, John, I have a question that has always puzzled me. Where did these ancient civilizations, where did the Egyptians learn all of this stuff? When you talk about astronomy, when you talk about architecture, it just seems like there is so much, especially let's use astronomy as an example, there is so much detail and so much information that has come out of there in that whole subject that if they were a primitive people, how could they know so much?
Well, this is all that does, actually, very good question, is that it pushes it further back into the past, but yet you end up with the same question, actually. In other words, I'm assuming, maybe incorrectly, that our audience knows about at least the basics of the Sphinx theory. That because it is weathered by water, and I won't go into a big song and dance about it, but it's weathered by water.
We're going to talk about it in the second hour, so.
Pardon?
We're going to spend some time talking about it in the second hour, but you can highlight it now.
Anyway, the water weathering means that the Sphinx is many, many thousands of years older than anything else that we know about, at least in what we call civilization. And how much older, we just plain don't know. But we're confronted, the reason why the theory is combated and gets all of the flack that it does is because not only is the Great Sphinx the most spectacular sculpture on Earth, almost nobody would disagree with that, but the temples surrounding it, in front of it and adjacent to it, are built of blocks of stone that go up to 100, 150 tons each. Gigantic blocks of stone that are slotted into place like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. Can't even get a piece of paper in between the joints. And, there's not supposed to be any. We're talking about, there are a couple of possible dates. Actually, a lot of possible dates. But one of them is 10,000 B.C. or thereabouts, because the Sphinx, with his lion body and the head of a man, screams out as a Leo marker, It faces due east, and you can't prove this, of course. There's no document that says it's intended to. represent the ingress into the age of Leo, but there is plenty of documentation that says that the precession of the equinoxes, a familiar, you know, age of Aries, age of Leo, age of Pisces, etc., etc., etc.
But I thought the age of Leo was like 13,000 years ago and not 10.
Well, it's about, 10, 12,000 years, depends on how you calculate this thing, but it's 10, 11,000 B.C., depending on how many years you ascribe to each of the processional ages. So there's arguments about that. At the moment, it changes. It's variable, even since they've been measuring it, which is only 100 and so years. At the moment, I think it is 25,770, something like that, of a processional cycle. But anyway, for our intents and purposes, 10, 12,000 BC, something like that. But the age of Leo before that would have been 26,000 years earlier, so somewhere around 36,000 BC. Either way, we're talking about the most spectacular sculpture on Earth, and the temples around it that are built with the technology that we today cannot reproduce. We don't know how they did it, and we couldn't do it ourselves. I mean, we can go send spaceships up, so if it were important to us, we probably could figure out a way to reproduce the temples, the Sphinx Temple and the Valley Temple, as they're called, that are around the Sphinx. Fact of the matter is that at the moment we can't do it. So we're suddenly confronted by a work of art that's effectively superior to anything we can produce today, and a couple of temples, and this isn't the only evidence. There are other substantial pieces of evidence around Egypt that we hope to address when we get a panel of geologists over there to look at this water weathering question once and for all. But we're confronted with works of art that both in emotional quality and in technological expertise are superior to anything we can produce today, built at a time when there's not supposed to be any civilization at all. So then the question comes, well, where did they get it from? And all we can say is, we don't know. We just plain don't know. I have some, let's say, conjectures as to how they might have acquired this information, and my least favorite conjecture, which comes up all the time whenever I do a lecture or when we're on site, you know, on one of my trips, or there are call-in. I don't know, do we have call-in on this program? Are there call-ins?
Well, we could,
people
but
call in
we don't get many calls.
No, I'm just wondering.
I like having intellectual conversations
okay.
with myself.
Okay, so I'm just wondering. I didn't know. Anyhow, it always comes up, you know, were aliens responsible? Well, to me, I don't dismiss that because there's just a lot too much information out there that UFOs are a very real phenomenon that nobody really understands, but it's just my least favorite explanation. I prefer to believe that human beings, rather like ourselves, but simply at a higher level of consciousness and a higher state of civilization, built these amazing things for reasons of their own, and we don't know why they built them. We don't know.
You know, the alien idea makes everything fit much nicer and neater into a package. It explains a lot of religious texts, religious traditions of ancient peoples. You know, so that
I'm sorry, I don't think it does. I don't think it does.
Well,
I don't think it does at all.
It just throws
the problem into outer space. How did they get those minds?
Well, that's a totally different. On Earth, where there was an earlier culture, the part that bothers me is that there, from that perspective, there is little to no evidence other than a few pieces and megalithic rocks that would support an earlier culture.
Oh no, there's more than you think. And actually, do you know about the find that they came up with a few years ago? Very important, as far as I'm concerned, one of the most important archaeological finds really of this century or the last one, in southern Turkey called Göbekli Tepe. Have you heard of that?
I don't know. Talk about it, and I'll let you know.
No. This is a major, this is a big deal. It's in southern Turkey, maybe, I don't know, 250, 300 miles away from Egypt. And it's, they don't know what to make of it. I mean, they discovered it, not deeply buried. Some peasants discovered it, kicking something around, and all of a sudden they started digging and discovered what they think is a ceremonial site. And they can date it pretty accurately because of the strata, the way they normally date things. Are we on a break here now?
A break, but we're going to come back to this after the break.
I'm talking to John
Anthony West about his book, Serpent in the Sky, and we'll be back after these words from our sponsor.
Just Energy Radio with your host, Dr. Rita Louise, will return right after these messages. Are you getting your greens? Now you can have your greens and drink them too with Innerfood by Inner Health Botanicals. Innerfood promotes health and boosts energy with nature's finest superfoods. Innerfood is 70% organic and 100% natural without fillers and is a whole food product totally assimilated by the body. Innerfood is spirulina, chlorella, dulse, kelp, spinach, alfalfa, barley, wheatgrass, rosehip, beetroot, and much more in real amounts, not just a sprinkle to fill out an inflated but impotent list of ingredients. Just mix a tablespoon in your protein shake or in your favorite fruit juice and you are good to go and go and go. Other greens on the shelf typically weigh 300 grams and sell for between $35 and $70. Innerfood is a full 400 grams, 33% more, for $39.95 plus shipping. Simply go to our website, innerstreamsradio.com, and click on any InnerHealth botanical banner and you're ready to order. Or call 866-762-9238 and be sure to mention you heard them on InnerStreams Radio. Innerfood, building health from the inside out. 70 million Americans suffer from sleep deficit. I'm James Afayanchik, the Black Knight of Talk Radio, and I'd like to tell you about Earth Pulse Magnetic Field Supplementation. While using your Earth Pulse device, I found that I drifted off to sleep faster, I slept deeper, and I woke up more refreshed, and it does much, much more. Call them right now at 888-211-7888, or check out their website at www.earthpulse.net. But wait, there's more. When you buy a new digitally programmed Earth Pulse version 4 magnetic supplementation device and use the special InnerStreams Radio coupon code ISR, you'll receive an instant $50 savings. No rebates to get lost in the mail. Just $50 more in your pocket on your way to better health. 888-211-7888 or check out their website at earthpulse.net and use the special InnerStreams Radio coupon code ISR. Earth Pulse. Deeper, more restful sleep, or your money back. The Berkey water system is more than a water filter. It's a natural purification system that yields 99.99% pure toxin and biopathogen-free water from any water source without electricity. Many supermarket paper and charcoal filters catch, for a while anyway, some impurities that make water taste bad. The Berkey ceramic hard rock filters with their zillions of little micro holes go much further and trap everything from parasites to bacteria to chemical toxins and molecular-sized contaminants, even fluoride and arsenic. Trace elements and minerals necessary for life are filtered out by most reverse osmosis systems. The Berkey systems allow these through to nourish and energize you, your family, your pets, and the plants under your care. What about lugging bottled water home every week? The Berkey pure water systems are many times more pure than the so-called spring water, and the cost convenience factor will amaze you. With simple regular cleanings, you're at your fingertips for under 2 cents a gallon. Our friends at Inner Health Botanicals are committed to providing natural, safe, and effective supplements and supplies to help you be your healthiest. Just go to innerstreamsradio.com and click on the Berkey water ad or call 866-762-9238 and make sure you tell them you heard about it on Inner Streams Radio. Real clean water at a real nice price. Oh, yeah. You want to host your own radio talk show? You provide the voice and the content. We do all the rest. www.innerstreamsradio.com for more information.
You are listening to Inner Streams Radio. Streaming from the inside out.
Just Energy Radio with Dr. Rita Louise. What am I made of? Why do I get sick? How can I live a more balanced and whole life? These are just a few of the questions that will be explored tonight by your host, naturopath, medical intuitive, and clairvoyant Dr. Rita Louise. Call in and talk to Dr. Rita and her thought-provoking guests. Get the help you need to move beyond any obstacle or challenges affecting your life right from the source. And now back to Just Energy Radio with your host, Dr. Rita Louise.
Hello and welcome back to Just Energy Radio. I'm Dr. Rita Louise and we're talking to John Anthony West about his book, Serpent in the Sky, www.jawest.net. So John, before we went to break, you were talking about the site in Turkey that they just recently found.
Yes.
And that they just kind of stumbled upon it?
Yeah. Some peasants sort of kicked the rock aside and all of a sudden there was another rock and they started digging around and all of a sudden they found it. Quite unprecedented, and dated now that they're still excavating. I mean, they believe that what they have excavated is only a part of a much more extensive ceremonial center. They have a clue as to what this was used for, and it was deliberately covered over at some point or another, somewhere around 8,000 BC. But this, from our point of view, it really provides a link, because they're always saying, well, how could there be anything, hunter-gatherers, blah, 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 blah. And all of a sudden, here is this amazing site in Turkey, constructed for reasons nobody understands, but of pretty major chunks of stone, 8-10 tons, upright, big megaliths, intricately carved in a style somewhere in between that of those Paleolithic cave paintings and the pre-dynastic carvings of ancient Egypt. It's quite reminiscent. I mean, it's not as though it's of a piece, as it were. You know, if you go far enough away, you go to China or India, the artistic style of, as old back, as far back as you go, the artistic style is quite different from Egypt. But this is somewhat similar, and you have very beautifully carved, intricately carved mythological animals, again, very typical, similar to Egypt. And even one thing that is a little figurine that has really escaped the attention of the archaeologists who've excavated it, because they don't think this way, but it's a little, not particularly sophisticated looking figurine. Don't know how big it is, maybe a foot or so. And it's isophallic, as the technical word means it has an erect phallus. But the phallus is placed on the site of the navel, not where it belongs. And you can be sure that whoever created that sculpture knew exactly where the phallus was supposed to be. You see this kind of representation in Egypt, and when you see that, talking about sometimes Osiris is where it belongs, and sometimes it's at the navel. But the point is, when it's at the navel, they know the difference. And the one is sexual reproduction, and when it's at the navel, it's cosmological reproduction. In other words, it's the principle of fertility as represented by the umbilical cord. In other words, that which connects us to the divine source, to the mother. So whenever you see a figure, a phallic figure, and the phallus is at the navel, they're talking about something that is not the material world. It's not the physical world, it's the metaphysical world. But suddenly you've got this extraordinary site, 10,000 BC or so, And they are talking metaphysics. It's not that they're an animistic society or anything of the sort. So for us, this is hugely important because it basically, it contradicts, it's no longer possible to say, well, how could it be much older than we say it is when there's nothing else that is anywhere remotely like advanced, sophisticated civilization earlier than 3000 BC, which is ancient Egypt and ancient China and ancient India and so on. And now suddenly, here we have 10,000 BC, a site that is megalithic in stature, in other words, big blocks of stone, 8-10 tons. Now, you know, an 8-10 ton block is no fooling around. I mean, you and I tried to, somebody said, well, here, we want to build, here, well, let's do a new age stone circle here. And what we want are 8-10 ton blocks. And you, Rita, you and John, you organize this. No machines allowed. We would have a problem. So as soon as you see 8-10 ton blocks being tossed around as if they were children's blocks for a kid's game, you know that you're dealing with people who have a technology in place. Now, whether or not it's machines that work for technology or some other, some mystical thing, people in a higher level of consciousness, I kind of like that one myself. But We don't know how they did it. All we can say is that they did it. And here we are at 10,000 BC, and here we have this elegant structure buried for reasons that we don't understand somewhere around 8,000 BC. I suspect it has something to do with astronomical, astrological considerations. But all of a sudden we have a chunk, a piece between our Sphinx theory and symbolist Egypt and a much more distant past. Now, having said that, there's another consideration that we automatically assume because of our own mindset, and that is that a truly advanced society has to manifest itself or express itself in highly technological and sophisticated structures. And this is actually a big mistake. This is the way we've been brought up to think. If they don't have atom bombs and bobblehead dolls in Disneyland, they can't be civilized, my God. But, and of course, we have got Egypt, and we've got China, and we've got India, and we've got all of these wonderful structures. But actually, if you look into what makes civilized people civilized, and you won't have any problem with this, some of, and probably our listeners won't either, but if this broadcast goes on, if there's a rationalist and a materialist listening to it, he or she will have a problem with it. But really, civilization, if it's understood correctly, in other words, let's go back to the point I raised earlier, that we're on this earth for a purpose. I mean, this is the whole notion of an esoteric society. We have a function to fulfill, which is to individually and collectively return to the divine source. In order to do that, all that's required is inner work. External work is not a necessity. I mean, the Egyptians did a lot of external work, but other people don't necessarily have to do that. So you could have a society, and probably some of the shamanistic societies are still somewhat like that even today. You could have a society of enlightened sages who expressed themselves only in dance, or mainly in dance, and lived in grass huts and wore bearskins or whatever, but where they are inside themselves is what counts. So,
and if you look at some of the really old religious traditions, the study of Kabbalah, Hinduism, they all are really working on the inner self. And the tradition is so vast and so large. One of the things I found interesting, there was the Neolithic guy that they found in the ice. I forget what his name, what they call, ended up calling him. And one of the things that they found on him were that there were these tattoos on his skin, but when they really started digging into it further, when they autopsied his body, they found that he had some kidney issues going on. He had a little bit of arthritis, and where the tattoos appeared on his body were the locations of major acupuncture points for supporting those organs and issues. And that was, you know, 5,000 BC, what he lived, or something like that, which is long before.
Yeah, something like that. 5,000 years ago, right?
Yeah.
Yes. That's right.
And that says that there is a whole body of knowledge that these people are working from when these civilizations came to fruit, or what see is coming to fruit.
That's right. Yeah, so, and, I mean, without going into the details, effectively, everything that they've ever taught us in any school that any that you or I or any of our listeners has gone to is completely wrong. It's totally and completely wrong. And they keep coming up with these things, and as I just said, and you used a good example, because, for example, it's always assumed that knowledge is acquired the way we acquire it, through experiment, and somebody has an idea, and you experiment to see if it's true, and then if it comes out, well, then somebody else has another idea that furthers it a little bit further. So knowledge grows what I'm looking for, by adding piece to piece. I don't have the word in front of me at this moment. But it's a bit at a time. It gradually grows. But noticing, because you bring up a good point, the Iceman has the tattoos on the meridians. Now, for years, actually, there are a number of reasons. There are a number of things of this nature, because I've always been interested in this. But acupuncture has always been the one that struck me to begin with. How did the ancients acquire the knowledge that they quite obviously and demonstrably had? And one thing is quite certain, they could not have acquired it the way that we acquire it. And acupuncture is a very great example for that, of that, because for you look at it. And how could you possibly develop acupuncture? What? Somebody's walking along the ground, a soldier or something like that, and he steps on a bramble or a thorn on his toe, and he pierces his toe, and then the next day he says, my kidney feels a bit better today. I wonder if that's because I stepped on a thorn and it hit my toe. And so he thinks, well, that's not
but that whole system the yogic system are all based on subtle energy, and that's not
that's
something
right,
that you can see, feel, touch. I mean, you can experience it, but it's not something that's remotely in the physical world. And now we're like beating people over the head to recognize it as something that's part of our lives. And that was something that was accepted and known and a known entity all the way back then.
But not only that, you see that they can't have acquired it by the normal way, what we consider the only way to learn things. They have to have got it. The only way they could have it is all at once. They can't develop it piece by piece. They have to have somebody somewhere along the line, or a group of people somewhere along the line, have to get the whole picture all at once. I mean, then they can add to it once they have it, but they can't have one meridian to work with. They have to understand the subtle. They have to understand the totality of, let's say, of the subtle energy body. There can't be any other way. And once you understand that, then all of a sudden, a lot of ancient mysteries become. They don't necessarily get solved, but you get the idea of how they went about doing it. For example, another mystery as spectacular as acupuncture is the domestication of animals and plants. And usually,
I was going to go there next, so go ahead.
Okay. Is that, they hung around the camp and then gradually they become domesticated. Well, this is absolutely ridiculous, because a lot of those animals are pretty edible. And if they were hanging around the camp, nobody is going to wait for them to become domesticated. It can't be like that. It has to be, somehow or another, I mean, I call it psychic genetic engineering. Somehow or another, A, to begin with, they had to know that it was possible, because, you know, life is difficult. And even things like domestication of plants, nobody's going to sit around going to all the trouble to plow the ground and sow seeds and say, well, let's see if in 300 years or 400 years we can make turn these into domesticated plants. They have to know in advance that this is possible. And I, in my opinion, they can only do that in some sense or another psychically. They have to know that they can do it, and then they do it somehow or another by mind power. We can't do it. We don't know. I mean, we've never domesticated anything since the original plants and animals were domesticated somewhere around 10,000 B.C. We've added nothing to it. I mean, we perfected the domestication process to a certain extent, but we haven't added to it. We've not domesticated a zebra or a fox. So those people had certain capacities, certain abilities that we no longer have. And only when that is recognized do we begin to get a sense of what was going on in those ancient times. And of course, the people who commandeered the whole discipline, the archaeologists and the Egyptologists and the anthropologists and so on, as I said earlier, are the people least capable of appreciating what they've got and least capable of emulating it, because they are fundamentally, this is, I mean, a creative scholar is a very rare bird.
So let me ask
you
this
question. These are mostly very uncreative people.
When you're talking about Egyptian archaeologists, I mean, if you change the timeline and say that there were people around 10,000 years ago, 20,000 years ago, that were creating culture, could it be that they're not interested in changing the current theories because there's too much religious pressure to not?
Oh, I don't think so. No. Yeah, there is a religious pressure, but it's not Islamic or Christian or Judaic or anything like that. It's the Church of Progress religious pressure. It's that. I'm dead serious. I mean, the only thing these people have to, let's say, nourish their souls, such as their souls are, is that they're the most advanced beings that have ever walked the face of the earth. And everybody else, even if they were creating sphinxes and pyramids and so on, is a lesser being. Because otherwise, this is, you know, this is, as I said, this is shiny barbarism, and it's basically, it's a nihilistic philosophy, and if you try to live it, I mean, they don't. Nobody can actually live pure nihilism. I mean, if you're really a pure nihilist, you pretty smartly commit suicide, because you can't live a life of total negation. So they, you know, so to them, getting an article published in Archaeology magazine, or winning some sort of stupid prize, respect of their colleagues. I mean, these are surrogates for food for the soul. But by and large, they don't think it through. It's just that in order to support their position as experts and as authorities, they have to deny anything that comes along that's new and interesting, and that ultimately, that challenges the dogma of the Church of Progress.
So let's talk about the Sphinx. So you were part of the documentary Mystery of the Sphinx. I'm not sure, you know, if you were the one that got it, you know, produced or whatever. And we talked about a little bit of what was on there, was about the weathering of the Sphinx temple area. And so, can you just go into a little bit more detail? I mean, because Robert Salk was the geologist that worked on that project with you. And can you kind of talk about what his findings were and what kind of reaction you got as far as his determination?
Sure. Well, really, we have to go back a bit to really understand it. And that is that Schwaller-Delibitz, who all of my work is based upon, I mean, I'm sort of Schwaller's self-appointed unofficial Boswell. And when I was doing my book, Serpents in the Sky, and doing the research, I came across this remarkable statement of Schwaller's in one of his lesser books, one of his last books that he wrote before he died, called, in English, The King of the Pharaonic Theocracy, Sacred Science, the King of the Pharaoh on a Theocracy. It's getting noisy in this restaurant, and I'm going to go outside onto the terrace here. And in a chapter in this book, he was talking about the chronology of Egypt and making a case for the Egyptian belief that their civilization started much, much earlier. And there are certain documents, I won't go into the details, but there are a couple of documents. There's a chronological tablet and there's a chronological papyrus in which the Egyptians talk about long reigns when first Egypt was ruled by the gods themselves, which are to be understood as cosmic principles, and then by semi-divine beings, kings, rulers, called the Shemsu Hor, the companions or the followers of Horus. And the regnal years of these rulers are given, and when you compute them all together, you come up with this amazing date of 34,000, 36,000 BC. And so Schmoller is putting together all of these sources from Greco-Roman antiquity and late Egypt and so on. And then at the end of this chapter, which is very well argued, but a textual argument is just a textual argument. It's not science. For example, you can argue from Natal Doomsday about a passage in Shakespeare or a passage in the Bible, and there are better and worse arguments, but you can't weigh it and you can't measure it. It's not science. And then all of a sudden he threw out this one line, and the line was, and of course the Great Sphinx of Giza shows unmistakable signs of aquatic erosion. And I read this, and the penny dropped in the slot, and I said, holy mackerel. If you could prove that, that's geology. I'm not a geologist, but that's geology. That's science. And if you could prove that, you would, in one fell swoop, turn all of history upside down. And so I started to do my homework. I was living in England at the time and traveling across the whole of London to get to the British Museum, boning up on my geology and developing this theory, which has lots of bits and pieces to it, and I won't go into it here, but actually, some of it is told in the video, in the Mystery of the Sphinx video. And you know, I developed this theory on my own, realizing that. And Schwaller himself didn't realize that this was the key to the whole thing. In other words, he could have done without that whole long chapter based on literary sources. All he had to do was say, hey, the Sphinx is much older because it's water weathered. But it didn't, I'm pretty sure it didn't occur to him that he had come up with this fantastic observation that nobody had come up with before. And it's just breathtaking, actually. But I saw that, and then, in fact, actually, even if Schmoller had known, he died the year after that book was published, but I'm pretty sure that he didn't recognize himself what a bombshell he'd come up with. So I then started doing all of my homework and developing the theory, which I published in Serpent in the Sky when it first published, which is almost 30 years ago now. And there it sat. You know, the book was hardly a bestseller. And when I tried enlisting the interest of geologists and Egyptologists, and I got back either abuse or nothing at all. And then through another set of strange circumstances, I met somebody who was interested in my work, and he was an academic himself teaching English at Boston University. And at some point he said, well, you know, the symbolist Egypt is really, this is important stuff. And I said, yeah, I know. And he said, really it's a pity that it's not better known. I said, yeah, I agree. And he said, you know, is there anything that in my position as an academic, and I said, is there anything I can do? And I instantly said, yeah, find me an open-minded geologist to look into the water weathering of the Sphinx. And I laughed because I use this line all the time in my talks. Finding an open-minded scientist is about as easy as finding a fundamentalist Christian who loves his enemies. They are very rare birds. And he said, no. He said, wait a minute. There's a guy who teaches with me at the college, at the undergrad college that I teach at within BU. And he might be interested. So anyway, long song and dance. Initially, he wouldn't even tell me Shark's name, and he said, don't you You stay out of this. You're too incendiary. Let me ask this.
Okay. All right. We're going to take a break.
Years.
We're going to come back and talk about the spin.
Got a break coming up, right?
I'm Dr. Rita Louise. We're talking to John Anthony West about Serpent in the book Serpent in the Sky, and we'll be back after these words from our sponsors.
Just Energy Radio with your host, Dr. Rita Louise, will return right after these messages.
Go deep inside yourself and venture into the realm of the unconscious mind with my Meditating on the Kabbalah guided imagery audio CDs. Discover who you are and what you want in life. Meditating on the Kabbalah can help you to open, clear, and revitalize the energetic pathways of your subtle being. They will support you in your spiritual quest by helping you to access the profound insights and inner guidance you need as you work in alignment with your highest good. Let them help you to release negative thoughts and emotions and clear away any limitations that may be keeping you from experiencing your full potential. Walk down the path to health, healing, understanding, and enlightenment with Meditating on the Kabbalah. Order your copy today at www.soulhealer.com. That's right, that's www.soulhealer.com. Hi, I'm Dr. Rita Louise, the host of Just Energy Radio. There's no greater blessing in the world than your good health. Science is now showing that simply eating a high-quality diet doesn't provide us with all the nutrition we need. Doctors recommend we supplement our diets with products derived from whole food concentrates. And one of the most complete and nutritious whole foods found on the earth are little microscopic plants called marine phytoplankton, which can be found in a product called Frequency. I've been taking Frequency every day for about 6 months now, and I feel more energized and full of life. If you're ready to make a difference in your health, I encourage you to try Frequency and see what it can do for you. To learn more about Frequency and other amazing whole food natural products direct from Mother Nature, please visit productsforthesoul.com.
Just Energy Radio wants to help you grow your business. Just Energy Radio has a growing global audience which can provide you with an unequaled opportunity to educate thousands of people about the products and services you have to offer. Through our targeted market, your ad is more likely to connect with like-minded individuals who will respond to your message. In addition, our archiving feature will allow your ad to be heard over and over again. Join the internet marketing revolution and take advantage of our low introductory prices. Visit JustEnergyRadio.com for more information.
Start the year off right by visiting livinggrocery.com. Experience the miracle of real nutrition as it helps you to lose weight and improve your overall health. Don't mess with pills or capsules. We provide the highest quality, all-natural, organic foods that come ready to eat. And best of all, it's delivered straight to your door. Visit livinggrocery.com now and experience your own amazing transformation.
Hi, I'm James Altayanchik, the Black Knight of Talk Radio. Listen to Dr. Rita's Soul Healer Moment live each third Sunday night of the month on Feet to the Fire. www.feettofire.com for more information. And now back to Just Energy Radio with Dr. Rita Louise.
Welcome back to Just Energy Radio. I'm Dr. Rita Louise, and we're talking to John Anthony West about his book, Serpent in the Sky. So before the break, we started talking about the weathering at the Sphinx, and you had just kind of found an open-minded geologist, which you thought was impossible. And you can pick up the story from there.
Okay, Rita. Yeah, so anyway, I finally, actually it was very interesting because I wasn't given Chalk's name, and I wasn't allowed to contact him until it was his direction to my friend who was the go-between, until he was up for tenure, and I understood what this was about. This was not cowardice, but looking for a lost civilization. That's the A word, Atlantis. And if if your colleagues think that you're looking for the A word for Atlantis, you're not going to get your tenure. So I appreciate that. So anyway, finally, along came the day when he was up for tenure, and he said, okay, now let's talk. And so he organized a talk for me at BU to faculty and interested students, and we met up, and he was, Shock was appropriately unacademic and strange looking, big, tall, gangly guy with long hair, and I realized instantly I could trust him. He wasn't one of them, and he was very super hyper cautious, and we scratched together a bit of money to get us over there. And again, all of this is a long story. One of these days, when we nail this theory down once and for all, there will be a big book coming out, probably co-written by Chuck and myself, and I'll go into all of this in detail. Actually, there's a lot of material on it. We haven't mentioned this one. I think you mentioned my website, jawest.net. But if anybody's interested, I've got these audio blogs, and I've got, how many have I done now? 9 altogether, going into Egypt and related subjects. And if people pull up the website, there's a click where you go Phoenix Fire or the blogs. And I go into, I think I spend a couple of hours going into the intricate details of the whole Sphinx theory, because it really is an interesting story. And in terms of annals of science, there is absolutely no doubt in my mind that the theory is correct and it will never be overthrown. And sooner or later, I hope in my lifetime, I'm planning to live quite a bit longer still, even though I've been here a long time already. I'll be around to see it happen. But this is a big, in terms of history of science and really history of civilization, it's, as I said, it's not my credit. I was smart enough to pick up on Schwaller's observation. I would not have observed it on my own. So it's a joint effort, a group effort. Anyway, Schock, when we finally got him over there, he was, I mean, hyper cautious. I mean, I couldn't get a declarative sentence out of him. All he could say at the end of a week there, just as tourists with no special permissions to do anything, any testing or anything like that, all he could say was, well, I can't disprove it. And initially, when he first saw the evidence, the photographic evidence, he actually didn't believe it because it seemed to him so obvious that he couldn't understand that nobody has seen it before. And, you know, for 100 and roughly, geology is a fairly new science. Well, I mean, all science is a fairly new science, but it really didn't begin until about 1840. But give it 150 years, geologists have been combing the Giza Plateau, and nobody up to Schwaller, who was not a geologist, noticed that the weathering to the Sphinx was water and not wind and sand. And Schwaller and Schock just couldn't imagine that anybody could not have noticed this. But now that, you know, that now I'm not a scientist. I started out as a novelist and playwright and scriptwriter and so on. And my intention had always been from the very earliest age to make as much trouble as possible for everybody. And I succeeded in doing that, but not so much through the novels and plays and scripts. Well, we'll get back to those one of these days, but through the scholarship. And that had always been the aim, and suddenly there was Schock and now agreeing that this was, you know, this was serious stuff. And then we put together some more money and got a real expedition together with a geophysicist, and then we were sure that Schock then was sure that the theory was correct, and we gave a presentation at the Super Bowl of Geology, which is the annual meeting of the Geological Society of America. This is 1991 we're talking about. And this was the big press. I mean, the GSA called a press conference, and the science press was there from all over the world, and the main journalists, you know, New York Times, the LA Post, everybody was there, New Scientist, all of that. And the geologists attending, thousands of geologists, were absolutely, as far as we know, 100%, I mean, unanimously convinced that our theory was correct. And when the word got out, because this was headline news, the geologists and the archaeologists, sorry, the Egyptologists and the archaeologists were, and I mean, they were in a fury. I mean, you never heard such a jibs. And so this was, of course, very gratifying. And having been dealing with these people for a couple of decades, I was not surprised and actually gratified. Anything less would have been a disappointment. And then one thing led to another, and because of the amount of press and then certain contacts that we made, the whole idea from the beginning was to do a big video about it, and we were introduced through a guy named Robert Watts, who was the producer of Raiders of the Lost Ark, and he had all the Hollywood connections, and so he got us past the secretaries at NBC.
Well, I'm wondering if I just lost him there for a minute. Well, hopefully he's going to come back on. This is pretty fascinating, the whole concept of the Sphinx being weathered by water. There are theories that say that, well, not theories, they know that Egypt was, there was water in Egypt, and the Sahara Desert was actually filled with plants and animals and a water system and rivers and a giant lake, I think, in the middle of it. And over time, it all just kind of dried up and went away. But they figured that there was water there prior to 7,000 BC. And so if the water went away at 7,000 BC, then if it was eroding, then obviously it would have to have been going on much, much longer than, you know, 5 years or 10 years for it to be eroded that way. I mean, I'm not sure how long it takes for rock to erode, and it's a kind of sandstone, not a really super hard rock. It's not a really super hard rock, but it's going to take years, hundreds of years, probably thousands of years, in order to get the groove pattern that's in there. So for the people that aren't really aware of what we're talking about, if you look at pictures of, there's the Sphinx, but the Sphinx is inside of kind of like a three-sided, it's surrounded on three sides by actually the main floor of the pyramid structure, because the Sphinx is right by the pyramid. And if you look at the side walls that go around the Sphinx, you look at them and it looks like water has been draining down them for years and years and years, wearing out the rock and weathering it down. And so, you know, if the desert came into play, or if Egypt dried up at 7,000 years ago, then obviously it must have had the Sphinx, because that area is cut out and they built the Sphinx based from the rocks. They quarried the rocks from there. It would have to be much, much older than the 7,000 years. I mean, I've read information in other books and from other authors that talk about the precession of the equinox, which we talked about a little bit earlier, where every 26,000 years, it goes in one cycle. So like in 2012, December 2012, it's when we're talking about we will be hitting the end of the precession, moving from the age of Pisces into Aquarius, which is in alignment with the galactic center, which is where they feel is the beginning of the cycle. Well, that is at this point in time. On the other side, you know, from an astrological point of view, on the other side of the zodiac is Leo. And so for Leo to be half of 26,000 years, which would be 13,000 years, and I guess that's why he was saying 10 or 11, because you have to take into consideration the AC, or A, D, B, C part, or B, C, E, excuse me, let's be politically correct. But that would put it back at 13,000 years ago, you know, 10,000 BC plus 2,000, 12,000, 13,000 years ago, which would have been the age of Leo. One of the things that they have found in Egypt and in many ancient cultures is that they would represent different things based on the period that they were in. And so, for example, there were the period where they worshiped the bull, and there were symbols of bulls, and there was, you know, there were just bulls everywhere. And then there was the period of the ram, and so, which was Taurus and then Aries. And so even in the Bible, they make a connection with where, you know, Jesus was a shepherd. And, you know, they shepherded sheep. But then after that period, at the millennium, the BCE to AD, we went into the age of Pisces, where we've been for the last 2,000 years. And if you think about Christianity, the main symbol of Christianity is the little fish, or the fish that says evolve, and it's depending on your point of view. Okay, so that's kind of more contemporary. So if you go back to the age of Leo, it would only make sense that they would reflect that in their art and architecture with things that are of a lion. And so there are people that believe that the Sphinx originally had a lion head on it, and at some point in time, like Khufu, the Egyptian guy, went and carved it into a head. And actually, they don't even think it's his head, because it doesn't match any of the statues that they have of him. But the head was carved on it at a later point in time. And if you actually look at the Sphinx, the head is disproportionately small for the rest of the body. So in my mind, it kind of works for me that it was originally a lion's head on that body. You know, one of the things that I wanted to talk to John about was about the relationship of the Sphinx with the pyramids, because they're both identified as being built at the same time by Khufu, you know, phonics. It just kills me every time. And that he built the pyramid, he built the Sphinx, or was involved with the Sphinx. But if the Sphinx is that old, and the technology that they used to build the pyramids is that complicated and that detailed that they still can't figure out how they were made, could it be, and is it possible, that the pyramids were also built during this previous period in time, and as John was talking about, either 13,000 years ago or 36,000 years ago, which would be very, very fascinating in my mind. 36,000 years, that's a long time. There were still mammoths walking around 36,000 years ago, and saber-toothed tigers. I mean, that's how long we're really talking about when we're talking 36,000 years. I do think it's fascinating, the concept that he brought up about, or the site that he was talking about in Turkey, where they found that whole, as he said, ceremonial center, you know, because everything is religious. But there's the music, so I guess I should stop talking. I'm Dr. Rita Louise. This is Just Energy Radio. We're talking to John Anthony West, author of Serpent in the Sky, and now you're just talking with me. And so after the break, if you want to call in and ask a question, I'm here. I'm available. The phone lines are open. Until then, I'll be back after these words from Mark Lund.
Just Energy Radio with your host, Dr. Rita Louise, will return right after these messages.
Hey, it's Dr. Rita Louise. Don't forget to sign up for our free online newsletter at justenergyradio.com. It'll keep you informed of who's coming on the show each week. And don't forget, explore your possibilities every Friday night. Don't miss a single episode of Just Energy Radio. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Are you feeling stuck and unsure which way to turn on your path? Do you lack focus and direction in life? Do you feel something is missing? So what do you want? A better job? Your dream home? More money? Your ideal mate? Decora has practical tools to assist you. Schedule a session today to get clear about what you truly desire to deliberately create the life you want. For more information, visit ManifestingConsultant.com or call toll-free 1-800-813-3877.
Are you sensitive to energy? Want to explore the world beyond the five senses? Looking for a new career as an alternative healthcare practitioner? Then the Institute of Applied Energetics, Medical Intuition, and Energy Medicine Training Programs may be right for you. Our comprehensive curriculum provides students with a deep understanding of how to detect, evaluate, and transform the subtle body, as well as techniques for correcting energetic imbalances that may underscore a person's ability to experience radiant health. So if you are sensitive to energy, contact the Institute of Applied Energetics right away. Be a catalyst for changing the way healthcare is done around the world. Visit www.appliedenergeticsinstitute.com and start your new career today.
Finally, there's a healing and ascension tool that delivers real results faster than you ever dreamed possible. Guaranteed. Feel your body release those lingering physical, emotional, mental, and spiritual blockages. Sense a profound awakening to your next level of intuition and oneness with your higher self. Discover Archangel Metatron's Healing and Ascension CDs at AtlantisHealthCenters.com. Visit AtlantisHealthCenters.com today.
The crossroads in your life and discover alternative solutions to your deepest concerns at soulhealer.com. So whether it's a physical problem, an emotional issue, a question about work, or troubles in your relationship, naturopath and medical intuitive Dr. Rita Louise can help you bring peace, harmony, and health back into your life. Schedule a session today. Visit soulhealer.com right away and live the life you've been dreaming of.
And now back to Just Energy Radio with Dr. Rita Louise.
Hello and welcome back to Just Energy Radio. I'm Dr. Rita Louise, and we were talking to John Anthony West about his book, Serpent in the Sky, but he disappeared. I think... Well, I just don't know where he went. So we're just going to visit for a while and just talk more about Egypt, because as I said at the beginning of the show, this is one of my favorite topics to think about and ponder on, because there are so many different things that you can throw in and possibilities, and none of them are being answered. I think that's the part that bugs me the most, is getting a conclusive answer, because the ones that we're getting from the mainstream archaeologists and Egyptologists, they just don't work. You know, one of the things that John talks about in his book, and I've questioned myself, is even about things like the hieroglyphs. I mean, you look at the monuments all over Egypt, and they are carved with hieroglyphic writing everywhere. But there is no information, there is no detail about the development of that writing style. There is no pre-hieroglyphics, there is no pre-Egyptian forms. In Judaism, when you write in Hebrew, when you write Hebrew, I guess that would be the alphabet too, they have very early texts where the forms are a little bit different, but there's still a commonality in the script. In Egypt, I would assume that there is some development, but the language came in fully developed. They were able to express concepts to their fullest. And the same is true all around the world. And actually, the earliest form of writing was out of Sumeria, where they used cuneiform as their written language. And I'm sure you probably have seen pictures of cuneiform, and it's just a series of like little triangles and lines and dots on clay tablets. And that language, even though it is weird to us to look at, it doesn't make any sense, but that was a fully developed written language, and they documented everything, just like the Egyptians documented everything. And that came out of, poof, nowhere. And if you think about how we learn how to write and how we learn to work with letters and work with the alphabet, it took us years in order to become experienced enough or have enough knowledge and understanding to be able to read and be able to write. And this is a culture. It wasn't like one person could read and write, or they decided, well, I'll just make up this language and I'll just make everybody learn it. It was something that was used throughout their culture. And so it leads you to the idea that it was there and it was well established long before those people came into existence. And that's the part that is the biggest mystery to me, is how did these people just come out of nowhere? I mean, it's almost like somebody planted them. There's evidence of them existing beforehand, but how did culture, how did, you know, as she was saying, domesticated animals and domesticated grains come into being? When we're talking about domesticated grains, there's wild grains like wild wheat and wild corn, and the seeds, the fruits of those grains are traditionally very small. And so you would have to collect a lot of grain to have very much stuff. But for some reason, somehow, unknown to everybody, corn went from being this little teeny tiny grain or small-ish grain to being basically what we see today, you know, a nice big piece of corn. How did that happen? I know, it was a vegetable miracle, like the gas miracle, but it was a vegetable miracle. There's just so much stuff out there that just boggles the mind. It boggles my mind. John didn't like this idea of aliens. I don't know. I kind of think the idea of aliens makes a lot of sense, because there would be evidence. I mean, 8,000 years ago, to me, isn't really even enough time to develop some of the stuff that they're talking about. And I don't know. I think there would be more evidence of people, of things out there in the archaeological record than we're seeing right now. There are some people that believe that many of the archaeological sites and the cultures of antiquity lived along coastal areas, which that's a great theory. I like that theory. And when the ice age ended and the water melted and rose sea level significantly, that many of these ancient sites were flooded and buried by water. Now, I kind of can dig that idea. And so if you're sitting underwater, so let's say for 10,000 years, you know, there might be just a bit of mud or something sitting on top of you, that it would make it difficult, you know, for archaeologists to go and find evidence, because it would be, one, potentially buried, and two, it would be underwater. And, you know, the advent of underwater archaeology is really kind of in its infancy still. But then there's that site in Japan that I'm not even going to try to say the name, the one that's underwater that looks like some kind of solid rock temple complex. And actually, Salk had gone out there, the geologist, and investigated it and felt like it was a naturally forming rock piece and wasn't a man-made object that had been put underwater, you know, that had been buried, sunk underwater, when the water levels rose. And I kind of found that a little bit hard to believe personally, because where it was found was not that far off the coastline, and if water levels had been 30 feet below, it would have been out the air and up on land. Anyway, there's the music. We need to get going. I'm Dr. Rita Louise. This is Just Energy Radio. Next week, we have Jim March coming on to talk about America Beyond Top Secret. And so, until next week, I'm Dr. Rita Louise. Thanks for all tuning in. Thanks for being up with the show tonight. And be blessed.
Join host Dr. Rita Louise each week at this time for Just Energy Radio. Point your browser to www.justenergyradio.com for more show information and to contact Dr. Rita. Until next time, remember, it's all just energy.